Born at the start of the baby boom, P.J. O'Rourke notes that his youngest cohorts, born in the last year that anybody thought it was hip to like Lyndon Johnson, are turning 50 now. We'd all be sad about getting old, he writes, if we weren't too busy remarrying younger wives, reviving careers that hit glass ceilings when children arrived, and renewing prescriptions for drugs that keep us from being sad. We can't retire. The mortgage is underwater. We're in debt up to the Rogaine for the kids' college education. And it serves us right. We're the generation that insisted that a passion for living should replace working for one. But P.J. O'Rourke, author, social critic, and cheerful curmudgeon, says the baby boom has some redeeming value. He'll tell us about it on Midday after the news. And welcome to Midday's second hour. Dan Roderick's here. Thanks again for joining us. Many of our listeners will recognize P.J. O'Rourke as a panelist on NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but his descent into madness began long before that. An all-purpose satirist, political writer, curmudgeon, and social critic, P.J. O'Rourke picks on his own generation with his latest book called The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. To be precise, the baby boom describes Americans born between 1946, after World War II, until 1964, when everybody got tired of making babies. Depending on who's counting, there are about 75 million boomers out there today wondering what happened to their lives. PJ himself was an early boomer, while yours truly was closer to the middle of the boom. Growing up in an era of peace and prosperity, PJ says baby boomers grew up pampered, protected, and self-absorbed to the extreme. We're not only diverse, he writes, but take a thorny pride in our every deviation from the norm, even though we're in therapy for it. We are all alike in that each of us thinks we're unusual. Fortunately, we are all alike in our approach to big, broad problems, too. We won't face them. Instead, we turn to websites, support groups, classes, self-help books, and alternative medicine. History is full of generations that had too many problems, P.J. O'Rourke writes. We are the first generation to have too many answers. But he sees redeeming virtues in the baby boom. Since Vietnam, we're not quite so likely to get into really big wars, just smaller ones with fewer casualties. Boomers and their kids have made this a kinder, more tolerant country than previous generations. True, he writes, boomers can be scolded for promiscuous sex, profligate use of illegal intoxicants, and other behavior that didn't turn out to be healthy. But somebody had to do the research, and we had a good time while it lasted. P.J. O'Rourke was a left-wing hippie when he earned his master's degree at Johns Hopkins and wrote for Harry, an underground rag here in Baltimore that lasted for 32 issues, and I use rag, affectionately. That helped win him a job as managing editor of the National Lampoon, where his most famous piece was titled How to Drive Fast on Drugs While Getting Your Wing-Wang Squeezed and Not Spill Your Drink. He also co-wrote National Lampoon's 1964 high school yearbook, the inspiration for the movie Animal House. And turning to the right, which he did, P.J. O'Rourke began a freelance career that made him a fixture at Playboy, Vanity Fair, Car and Driver, and Rolling Stone. He's written some great stuff over the years. He's written 17 books, including a best-selling treatise on U.S. government called Parliament of Whores. He continues his compulsive writing in The Atlantic, American Spectator, and Weekly Standard. And P.J. O'Rourke is the H.L. Mencken Research Fellow at the Conservative Cato Institute. P.J. O'Rourke, it's a pleasure to get you on our show here at little old WYPR. Thank you for making time for us.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. And it's great to be back in Baltimore, if only in spirit.
You know, there are folks out there who heard me just reference Harry. I said I used the word rag affectionately there. Would you mind just telling our listeners a little bit about Harry?
Well, Harry was Baltimore's underground newspaper, which, of course, makes it sound like it was some sort of illegal activity. And while we may have been involved in some illegal activities, publishing the newspaper wasn't one of them. We called underground newspapers in the 60s were so called after the French resistance newspapers, you know, where the Gestapo would actually chop your hands off if they caught you, you know, peddling them on the street. We've always been a self-dramatizing generation. Harry was started in 1969 by Tom D'Antonio and Michael Carliner, and Tom, a native Baltimore guy. And it lasted actually a little longer than that, I think. And Tom revived it for a while in the 70s. And it was always one of the better-natured underground newspapers. It wasn't so much... we weren't into weather underground violence. We were more into testing waterbeds.
And do you think it was more than 32 issues? That's what I had.
I think it was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I think it was. Well. Yeah, because it came out weekly. Of course, that was a very theoretical week. You know, that meant, you know, when we sort of like ran out of pot and then had to put out another issue. I mean, we basically made our living by selling this on the street for a quarter. And Tom is a big guy, and he had, like, very bushy beard. And, of course, the newspaper had this strange name. And Tom could stand on the corner and yell, "Harry," and people would give him a quarter and not even take the paper.
I remember, Tom. This all happened before I got to Baltimore. You had moved on by then. I got here in the mid-70s. But I heard people were still talking about Harry then.
Yeah, it was. Quite a few people were involved as artists and writers, and you know, and we still owe you money.
PJ O'Rourke, our guest in this hour of Midday. Listen, I'm very happy to see you write a book about the baby boom generation, because we've heard a lot about the greatest generation. I mean, there's been a lot on the greatest generation. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
Not that they weren't great.
But when I get to this subject, the baby boom, because your whole book is about what defines us, who we were and all that. Aside from having been born between 46 and 64, what do we have in common? And I know that's a huge topic, but it is.
And it was daunting at first when I was trying to think this book out, because we spanned so many years, and I ended up dividing the baby boom up according to sort of senior class and junior class, sophomore class, freshman class. So like me and Cher would be senior class. You sound like you're maybe junior or sophomore.
I would
class.
Be according to your the breakdown here. I'm in the junior class, right? I'm right behind
you. You're in the junior
you.
Class, yeah, okay? Right. Well, and that's good company. That's where Bill Gates, Steve Jobs are in the junior
right,
class.
Right.
And like freshman class would be the president and the first lady would be mm-hmm. in the freshman class. But you know, I'm looking around at all the things that you know that we had in common, trying to you know form my themes. And while doing the research, one of the main things I found out was median family income. You know, not average family income, because average can be distorted by numbers at the top and the bottom, but median family income, where half the families make more than this and half make less. It's an important figure. The median family income for baby boom, when we were growing up, baby boom, to leave it to Beaver years, is $10,000 more than what the greatest generation median family income was. Right. $10,000 inflation adjusted, $10,000 real dollars. And not only that, but if you look at the economic growth from like 1946, when the first baby boomers are born through the last, you know, birth cohort, it's a very steady upward slope. A hopeful, optimistic, growing American economy. There's like one or two tiny dips in there, but almost negligible. That per capita GDP just keeps climbing. And then if you look at the same figures from back in the days of the greatest generation, what you see is like when they're growing up, per capita GDP, amount of goods and services produced in the country per person, it goes up, it goes down, it goes way up, it goes way down. I mean, their best year, 1929, is only like 2 years away from the depths of the Depression, from their worst year. And so the parents of the baby boom, the greatest generation, had a very different, I mean, not only were they poorer, but they were living in much less stable and secure economic times. And I think that's really what makes the difference between the, you know, like, I'm supposed to be a humorist, you know, and I'm trying to make a joke out of this, and I'm not having any luck here. But if I had to, but if, you know, you ask me the question, like, what really defines the difference, it's that 10 grand.
Mm-hmm. You know, also there's experiences, and we can look to the greatest generation. You just mentioned the Depression, of course, World War II. But because the baby boom generations covers such a wide span, it's hard to say what our common experiences. Yeah, I mean, you could say the Vietnam War, but that wouldn't be true for people born in 1960, 61, 62.
No, and of course, it's much more true for Vietnam veterans than it would be for people like me who dodged the draft, you know. And the veteran, the number of veterans per age group cohort, number of people who actually went to Vietnam compared to the number of people who were theoretically eligible to go to Vietnam, was a pretty low ratio compared to, say, in the greatest generation, the number of men who were theoretically liable for military service, factored into the number that actually went. That ratio is much closer to 1-to-1 during World War II than it is during the Korean War, much less so during the Vietnam War. And what were we talking about?
Well, what we have in common is experience.
But the experience that we do have in common, one thing that we really have in common...
Drugs?
...is television.
Oh, television. Okay.
Television. I mean, television basically comes with the baby boom. Mm-hmm. I mean, I remember when we got our first television. It was in time for the 1950 presidential elections. We got a television in 1950. There were only three channels. And so... we all watched the same thing. And, of course, the main type of entertainment besides television was the movie theater. And there would be just, you know, one movie theater per neighborhood and always show. So all of the baby boom grew up. We all saw the same movies. We all saw the same television programs. Differs a little bit with age cohort, but not that much. And so we have this, like, commonality of worldview.
That's indeed true, but you know, we're still in the shadow of the greatest generation because they had real experiences. They had, you know, deprivation, they had dysfunction,
yeah.
lack
Absolutely.
Of stability, as you say. What do we have? We had television.
We had television.
Yeah.
And we had security, and we had, eventually we would get to drugs.
Yeah.
No, we had a couple of things going for us that I don't think any other generation in history, not just in America, but anywhere in history had. That the baby boom had, which was this, like, security, economic security, optimism, not just economic optimism, but optimism of all kinds, very big in the 50s and early 60s. And we had the stable family existence. We came largely from two-parent families. Divorce was still very rare. Single motherhood still very rare. And I mean, even the most, you know, even in the lowest economic strata, where single motherhood if you go back to like 1949, the number of single mothers among extremely poor people is lower than it is now among rich people.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very and this is an amazing piece of, you know, sort of. A decade and a half of peace and stability and prosperity and opportunity that gave us a kind of confidence that we could do anything and that the world was perfectible that I don't think any other generation has ever had. And you'll note when we get to the, you know, middle 60s and we find out that the world isn't perfectible and the president has been shot and then Martin Luther King gets shot, the war, of course, breaks out, the draft, we discover drugs, we discover sex, we invent sex. When we find out that the world is not perfectible, we throw quite a temper tantrum, which would have been the 60s.
Right. The baby boomers, you keep saying that we're spoiled, that we didn't have to work as hard. So do you think our parents just wanted us to have a better life? So they
Yes.
Yeah. That was the idea,
yeah.
right?
They really did. And how did we repay them? By being incredibly furious at them in the 60s. Not only being furious at our parents, but being furious at their whole world, the whole world of straights and squares. You know, we rejected that out of hand, which is a lot of us are still feeling kind of embarrassed about, especially if our parents aren't around to apologize to, you know. Wish mine were.
P.J., we're going to take a break here, and we'll come back and talk some more. Our guest in this hour of the show, P.J. O'Rourke, perhaps you've read his work, or you've heard him on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again, the latest book from P.J. O'Rourke, our guest in this hour of midday. A lot more things now come standard with our standard of living, thanks to all the great stuff we've invented. In 1978, few people had a personal computer, and if they did, it took up half the house. There was no GPS in your car. The greatest generation was lost all the time. You had to go to the library to look things up, and then you couldn't because the Dewey Decimal System made it impossible to figure out whether Dewey ran for president against FDR, defeated the Spanish Navy in the Battle of Manila Bay, or invented the Dewey Decimal System. We may not have managed America's money well, but the boomers' demand for more and better gizmos has filled the nation with amazing playthings, from tiny talking computers to gigantic flat-screen TVs with roughly 2,000 channels to watch on them. We're the generation that will die with the most toys. A quote there from P.J. O'Rourke, our guest in this hour of the show and the author of The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. P.J., Harry is calling us, not the newspaper you worked for, but Harry in Severna Park, Maryland.
Harry the person.
Harry the actual person who can't stay on the phone very long, so I agreed to just put him right on the line with you, okay?
Good, let's go.
All right, let's go, Harry.
And I bought the magazine because I didn't want you to blow that poor dog's brains out.
That was a reference to a National Lampoon cover, I'm glad to say was not my idea, where we had an adorable dog with a gun next to its head saying, you buy this magazine. If you don't buy this magazine, we'll shoot this dog. That's the hard sell marketing.
God. Yeah. Harry. So Harry goes back a ways. Okay, good.
Do, Harry.
Yeah, I'm not sure which corps I'm involved with, but I was born in 50, and I remember the Hungarian uprising and the Cold War and sitting enthralled and watching Cuba and stuff, and I'm like, what kind of effect did that have on us?
Having grown up through the Cold War?
Yeah.
Okay.
PJ? Yeah, it definitely, even the brightest, most brightly lit life, you know, has got its shadows in it, and those that threat of the Cold War. Although I personally found as a kid that getting under the desk because there was going to be an atomic bomb, you know, I thought that was more fun than arithmetic. And I also had my friends and I were kind of convinced, you know, subconsciously, I guess, that atom bombs killed adults, you know, and that we would basically, you know, we would be left kind of on our own and unsupervised, you know, and which we thought was like a swell idea in a weird sort of way, you know. I mean, it's I think it's been a little overstated, the amount of like tension that the Cold War caused in baby boom children, because we're children and we didn't really, it was pretty abstract, the idea entire world blowing up.
But you know what, the time I do remember really feeling the fear was Cuban Missile Crisis. That was real. Kennedy was on TV and the parents were very concerned.
And I've got a story about that in the book. You know, I too was concerned. We were. I mean, it was a near run thing. So I had this lab partner, a very cute Irish girl, and who I had kind of a crush on, enough of a crush on that I dissected her frog for her, okay? So I say no more. And, you know, and she'd like write down in the lab notebook, you know, why I shielded her eyes from the horror of the frog innards, you know? And so, you know, about a month later, we got the Cuban Missile Crisis, and we were sophomores in high school, and I turned to her and I said, Katie, let's do it. Let's you and me. Let's do it. And she kind of looked at me. She kind of looked at me like she'd looked at the frog innards. You know? and I said, no, I'm really serious about this because we may all be dead in a couple of days, and we don't want to die without having done it, right?
Right.
And she actually said, look,
She said, I'll think about it over the weekend, okay? And over the weekend, the darn missile crisis was solved,
you know, that's too bad.
Leaving me for a virgin for another 5 years or something. You know?
But PJ, you do give the baby boom generation credit for some things, including maybe the end of the Cold War, the bringing down the destruction of the Berlin Wall. You know, that was, most people attribute that to Ronald Reagan, Mikhail Gorbachev. Of course, they get the praise for that. But
yeah, they do. They get the credit.
Yeah, but we're the ones who sort of turned the rest of the people in the Soviet bloc onto how life could be.
Well, that's it. You know, we were having a great time. We were obviously having a great time, and it's no accident that the crack in the Iron Curtain happened in Berlin, because that's where communism was like face to face with Western society as the baby boom has manifested it. And you know, they could peek over the wall and see what a good time was being had in West Berlin, and they could get West German television. You know, these two countries did not speak different languages. It wasn't like Russia. It was very hard to isolate the East Germans from what was going on in Western Europe, which was very similar to what was going on here, which was a darn good time. We remember the 80s, you know, party mm-hmm. on. And I really think that had much more to do with, you know, the East Germany got a new leader, and someone had the nerve at a press conference in East Germany to say, you know, will you lessen the travel restrictions to West Berlin and to West Germany? And he said, yes, I will. And the reporter pushed Putin. He said, so well, when? And the guy was like sort of on the spot, and he kind of impulsively, he said, well, tonight at midnight. That was Thursday midnight. Yeah, right. That was when the wall came down.
Right.
And it was like, did I say that aloud? And next thing you know, everybody's pouring through the wall, you know, and going to have a beer.
PJ O'Rourke, The Baby Boom, his book, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again. So about the subtitle, if you don't mind, because I enjoy the subtitle. But, I mean, it does suggest that boomers are a bunch of sniveling, you know, cowering apologists or something like that. Is that how you mean it?
I didn't know what the heck to call this book, and my publisher didn't know what the heck to call it either. He and I are on the phone trying to figure out, you know, boom. You know, we had all sorts of, like, non-clever ideas. And I said, you know what I'm trying to get across in this book? I'm really kind of trying to get across this is, like, I'm trying to embrace the whole baby boom, and I'm also, you know, trying to get across that you know, how did that baby boom get that way? And it wasn't my fault, and I'm not going to do it again. You know, I'm just talking to him, and he says, wait, we have the title.
There you go.
So it was an accident. It was totally an accident.
Self-examination is not easy, though, is it?
Well, especially it's not when you're, I think, when you're, not to pat myself on the back here, but what I was trying to do, I mean, it's one thing to write a memoir. And when you're writing a memoir, it's about how, like, special and different your life was, you know, because your parents beat you with crowbars, usually. You know, I mean, I haven't read that many happy memoirs, but they must exist.
You got a point there, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know
we see a lot of memoirs here on the radio show, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you don't know what it is with the memoir writers, but they usually have a little score to settle or something, yeah. What I was trying to do, I mean, this book is part memoir, but what I'm trying to do is to get other people to evoke their memories of similar experience. You know, I mean, we were all in it together. We were kind of a unitary generation, probably more unitary than any other generation ever will be, because now it's so easy to sort of fracture and find your own little, you know, group on the web that you and another eight people who are obsessed with, you know, fill in the blank,
right.
Beanie Babies. You know,
right.
You can get in your little Beanie Baby group. And not have to pay attention to the rest of society. You couldn't do that back in our day. So what I'm trying to do the way I think of it is like put yeast in the bread of memory. I'm using my own memories to seed other people's memories, you know. And so in that sense, it's not a memoir. I don't talk about what was different with my life. You know, I talk about what was the same with my life, what was the same with as many other people. And I'm a very average guy. I come from the middle of the country. I come from Toledo, Ohio. My family actually did. I looked it up. My family actually did have the median income in the early 50s. This median income of American families. We, you know, Toledo is like about 100 miles from the population center of America. We were utterly middle class. We're mixed Irish, German, French, English, you know, and we grew up in, I grew up in a very ordinary suburb, post-war house, you know, nice, comfortable, nothing fancy, went to public school. So I thought, you know, I'm a good, like, you know, test case for all this. Why not use my very ordinary experience to talk about what ordinary people went through?
Mm-hmm. Several years ago, the poet Robert Bly had a book called The Adolescent Society, and he's a great generation person. And he was very critical of, I think, well, mainly the baby boom, actually specifically Bill Clinton, I remember in that book, and he used this phrase, adolescent society, actually sibling society, that we were a generation of siblings and no one really wanted to be an adult because the adults had come before. Now, maybe every old crank in every generation says something like that. Not that Robert Bly is an old crank. I respect
but,
his right.
But, you know, what did you... did you say that aloud?
I guess I'm not allowed to say that. Quick, somebody beat some drums and give me some oil for my chest. But anyway...
I think we could fairly call him an old crank.
Yeah, but, I mean, with that comment, I did wonder... I remember reading that book right around the time of the Clinton impeachment hearings in Congress,
yeah,
and thinking,
yeah,
you know, I think he's got a point about what's going on, first with the president and also how Congress was handling that whole thing.
Yeah, it was. It was seventh grade, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, he kissed her. Did not.
What do you mean by it? Anyway.
Really, let's not go there.
But PJ, what about that criticism that the baby boomers, we didn't really want to be the adults?
I think it's a valid criticism. I think it is an absolutely valid criticism. The only thing that I would disagree with about that is that that he's being critical of us for it, you know?
Yeah.
No, we didn't want to grow up. You know, why? Because the behavior of grown-ups, as long as we've had recorded history, in you know, however many thousands of years, at least 5,000 years of history that we know about, grown-ups have behaved horribly. Absolutely horribly. They have murdered each other. They've enslaved each other. They have exploited each other in every conceivable way. And no, we didn't want to be grown-ups. You know, does that mean we were also didn't want to take on grown-up responsibilities like, you know, getting married, settle down, having two parents for the child? Yeah, we got to plead guilty to that too. But the fundamental reason for us not wanting to become grown-ups is two. One, grown-ups are awful. We got 5,000 years of history to prove it. And two, being a kid is just a lot more fun. You know? And so what is wrong with more fun and less horrid behavior other than, you know, a little bit of irresponsibility?
Let's take another call for PJ O'Rourke here on Midday on WYPR. Jason, right near us in Charles Village. Go right ahead, Jason.
Yeah, hi, Dan and PJ. Just not quite as light of a thought, but one of my criticisms, I'm at the very tail end of the of the boomers, but is that the generation completely dropped the ball on the Iraq War, having gone through most people knowing about the Vietnam War, the disaster that it was, the way it came about and was escalated and all that, and then didn't stand up and prevent Iraq from happening, or even once it was discovered that the whole thing was based on bogus reasons, hold people accountable and end it. And it just seems to me that while they get credit, like you're saying about ending the Cold War, I condemn this generation for completely, you know, the people who were protesting Vietnam and all that, but then when it came to Iraq, it was complete.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just curious what PJ thinks. I haven't heard his opinion about that, so I'm not sure. I'm just curious what he thought about that.
Gulf of Tonkin resolution, I just think. No one remembered the Gulf of Tonkin resolution.
Yeah. I know. You know, that's a fair point. It's absolutely a fair point. And you're talking to the right guy, too, because I advocated that war. I went and covered that war. I lost one of my closest friends in that war. And I think that war turned out really, word we can't say on radio-y. The aftermath was terrible. The reason I cannot give you an excuse for what I think is looking back on it was quite a serious mistake. I can give you, however, the reasoning behind this. And I don't think my reasoning, you know, why I'm not, you know, George W. Bush was not calling me and asking my opinion, but I don't think my reasoning is too far off of his reasoning. And the other guy who I'm talking about here is Mike Kelly, who was the editor for years of the New Republic. He was a Democrat.
Used to work for the Baltimore Sun.
He worked for the Baltimore Sun. Yeah. That's absolutely right. He was the son of of the shop steward at the old Washington Star. Mm-hmm. And he was then, at the time of the Iraq War, he was the editor of The Atlantic. And I was working for him, and I was a foreign correspondent for Mike. He was a close friend. We had kids the same age, and great guy. And Mike too, advocated the war. And the reason that we advocated the war was that he and I had both covered the Gulf War, and we had seen what the Iraqis, what specifically Saddam Hussein and his henchmen, what they had done to the Kuwaitis while they occupied Kuwait. The rape, the murder, the wanton destruction of property. We had driven through the desert while all those oil wells were burning. And we were both convinced that Saddam Hussein was just an absolute evil man. And in the wake of 9/11, we just felt that Mike and I both felt that this was like an evil chess piece on the big chessboard, a big evil chess piece, and it really needed to be taken off the board. Neither Mike nor I particularly bought the weapons of mass destruction, because what we felt was Saddam Hussein, he is a weapon of mass destruction. Look what he did to Kuwait. Look what he did to the Shiites. Look what he did to the Kurds. Look what he'd like to do to a lot of other people. We supported this. And I was in Baghdad while the fighting was still on after Mike got killed during the assault on the Baghdad airport. And I was in Kuwait, because I wasn't embedded, you know, and I had to call my wife, who knew Mike and knew the kids, and I had to say to my wife, Mike died, Mike was killed, and I'm going into Baghdad to take Mike's place. Not a phone call that I would care to make again. And I got to say, I got a very stand-up wife. She's a daughter of a retired career FBI agent, and she said, she was crying, and she said, if you feel that this is really important, and I said, I think this really is important. I think this is a moment that's going to shape our world, which it was, but it was not a moment that shaped our world for the better, as it turned out. But when I got to Baghdad, I got to say that the people in Baghdad, they were quite leery of the American troops, but I walked around unarmed and not with it, all by myself in Baghdad, talking to people. A lot of Iraqis speak English. I got some hard looks. I also got some handshakes and some big smiles. They were really glad to have that guy gone. Really glad to have that guy gone. But we then proceed. The rest of the story is not very pretty. I mean, we mismanaged every aspect. I could go on for hours about this.
We could go on naming evil guys around the world who maybe should be taken off the board,
Well, isn't that the truth? Mike and I were being a little simplistic about this, and the reason was emotional. The reason was because we had seen what we had seen in Kuwait. And Mike and I mean, it wasn't like we were newbies here. He and I both covered a fair number of war zones. It wasn't our first rodeo. But we were so devastated by, what we saw had been done to the Kuwaitis and in Kuwait, that we let emotion
The problem is there were so many who didn't have those experiences, who couldn't claim those experiences that you're describing supported the war from a great distance away in Washington.
There's more than a little truth to that, but that doesn't excuse me or Mike Kelly, whose memory I revere. Who's my son's middle name is Kelly. Is that that doesn't excuse us from not thinking more carefully about what we were supporting and proposing. On the other hand, we didn't have the power to go to war. We're reporters, so nobody listens to us.
Right. PJ, we need to take another break. We'll come back and talk some more and take some more calls. PJ O'Rourke, our guest on Midday, The Baby Boom, his book, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again, a jaundiced view of the generation that set out to change everything but mostly didn't, although he still finds a few good things to say about us, 75 million or so baby boomers born between 1946 and 1964. Some are on Social Security. Some are turning 50 this year. Writing about the baby boom and baby boomers, P.J. O'Rourke says, every time opportunity knocked, we let it in, even when it should have been locked out for decency's sake. And behold the boomers' remarkable experiments with prosperity. The dot-com bubble, the housing bubble, the enormous financial bubble that still got the nation trying to get fiduciary gum out of its hair. And one wonders if the baby boom generation has blown it for the next generation. The millennials and those who are coming after us are wondering, what have you left us? You left us kind of a mess here. Not as much opportunity as you were handed by your parents. So have we kind of blown it for the next gang coming up, PJ?
Probably.
It's a
sorry.
Mess. Yeah, it's a mess.
I don't know. Have we been the most financially responsible generation in the history of mankind? No, we have not. On the other hand, we have been remarkably innovative. I mean, we've changed the world economy in a really radical way between globalization and digitalization. And that's, you know, the digital revolution is our baby. You know, we may not know how to use all the devices, and we may not be able to understand all the apps, or maybe we can't figure out how to get our cat on YouTube the way younger people can. But we did invent this stuff, you know.
Right.
And I feel that in the long run, this is going to open up enormous economic opportunities for people all around the world, and that the net effect of this in the long run will be good. The net effect of the baby boom in the short term, not so good, for two reasons. One is this very wave of innovation. All innovation is disruptive. It has a destructive side. The great economist Schumpeter talked about the creative destruction of capitalism. I mean, industrialization in the world, the Industrial Revolution, led to much wealthier world, much less hunger, a much better life for a huge number of people in the world. But it did so at the expense of some extreme destruction of agrarian societies. We're about to start paying for the global warming from all the coal and junk we burned. It wasn't without its price, and the digital revolution ditto. So that's one reason that the baby boom has left the younger generations in hot water, in the soup. Mm-hmm. Another reason for this, and this one's not our fault, is that the greatest generation and the generation before the greatest generation, which I think of as the idiot generation, you know, the generation that started World War I and couldn't avoid World War II, which are not our parents, that's our grandparents' generation. They set up these two systems, Social Security and Medicare in particular, without any, they never bothered to look at demographic trends. I mean, Social Security is a system that works great if everybody dies at 77 and a half, you know. Medicare is a system that works great if everybody dies at 77 and a half and only needs an aspirin.
They didn't see the baby boom coming.
They didn't seem to see anything coming. You know, there have been when Social Security was set up, there had been a long-term trend that demographers knew about of longer lives of American people. As we got more prosperous and better fed and so on, people were living longer. Medicine was improving. This wasn't a million years ago. This is the 1930s. That trend was already evident. A trend was not factored into Social Security. Even worse is the example of Medicare. By the time Medicare comes around in the late 60s, we know for sure that Americans are living much longer lives. And we also know that medical care costs are increasing. I mean, they're increasing, and they're not just increasing in proportion to the age and the number of people, but things like open heart surgery are being invented. The heart-lung machine is being invented. All of a sudden, you know, people who just would have died are being successfully treated, but it costs money. And any fool standing there in 1968 could guess that it was going to cost more money in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And neither of these gigantic entitlement programs factored in any of that. And yet you can't blame, I mean, you can blame the baby boom for taking advantage of these entitlement programs, but you can't blame us for inventing them. It was the grown-ups that did that.
You point out in the book that life expectancy in the U.S. has increased by almost 12 years since the baby boom was born. Yeah. PJ, some more callers for you. Let's go to Joel in Essex
sure.
and hear from him next. Hi, Joel.
Hey, Joel.
Hi. Enjoying the show immensely, as usual.
Thank you.
And you're welcome. I was born in 1958, so I was socially conscious in the 60s. I was there. I remember Kennedy's death and yeah. all of the things that were going on. But I have
to
say
belong to what I call the sophomore class.
Right.
Okay. That's what I thought as well. But turning 18 in 1976 was a magical point in time. At that time, the voting age was dropped from 21 to 18, the drinking age 21 to 18. There was no herpes. There was no AIDS. You did not have to register for the draft anymore when President Carter came into office in 1976. And from 1976 throughout the end of the 70s, man, that was a good time.
It was pretty high inflation. Well, wait a minute. There was pretty high inflation there in the 70s.
If you had a job, you went to buy a house,
and you paid 12 or 13% interest to get a loan on a house. Joel was a little younger. He's a little younger.
I'm a little older, but yeah, it was a terrible time to try and make a living, but I wasn't trying. It was an awful time if you had, if you had any money, but I didn't have any money, so it was like a, net loss thing.
It was good and bad in that period. I mean, there were the tall ships in 1976 came into Baltimore. That was good.
My memories of the era are very fine. Yeah. Of course, I was living in New York at the time, and let's face it, the place was dangerous. I lived on East 2nd Street between Avenue B and Avenue C, trendy neighborhood now. We called it Firebase Baker and Firebase Charlie. It was just terrifying back in the 70s.
Here's Nate in Baltimore. You're on Midday.
Hey, Nate.
Yes, good afternoon. I'd like to remark on the comment earlier that the baby boom generation earns, compared to the earlier generation, $10,000 more. And I would like to say that I believe it came at a big cost. Number one, we just mentioned the high inflation rates that resulted from more money in the money supply. And I also think that it came at a cost that today we have, because of that, we have less moms at home with the children, and the consequences from that are enormous. Mm-hmm. Because they all have to go out and work to pay for the increased inflationary cost that resulted.
Yeah. Well, we didn't earn $10,000 more than the greatest generation. We spent $10,000 more than the generation. It was when we had $10,000. I'm talking, and incidentally, I'm talking about chain dollars, about inflation-adjusted dollars. So this is real money. I've allowed for the inflation here. It's just that we grew up in an atmosphere that was $10,000 richer than our parents. Now, did that lead to some irresponsibility? As the caller pointed out, the whole idea of single parenthood, of not like getting married and staying married and getting a job and keeping a job. Are we a lot sloppier about that than our parents' generation? Well, of that there is no doubt. The statistics don't lie on that. I mean, can you imagine in 1950s, like a television show about 16-year-old, a reality show about 16-year-old girls with having babies? I mean, there was probably like one. somewhere they had to go way the heck out into I don't know where that wouldn't have been much of a show back then.
Here's another call for PJ O'Rourke. Dave in Baltimore. Hi.
Hi.
Hey, Dave.
Yes, I just want to make a couple comments. One, I'm in the senior baby boom generation, I guess, and served in Vietnam, 67, and I was among, 200,000, 500,000 people in D.C. and New York that were opposed to the war in Iraq. And there were a lot of people, my generation, that I saw out in those crowds walking down the Fifth Avenue or whatever, Pennsylvania Avenue. And I guess secondly, you know, I think sometimes we're saddled with what our forefathers had planned, like a lot of the things going on in the Middle East, Syria. This was all divided up after World War One. John Foster Dulles, he sort of set up the Vietnam War. This was not baby boom. This is pre-baby boom way back. So we're saddled with some things that we have to work out.
Thank you very much, Dave. Thank you. Yeah, and
someone else made
the same comment about some boomers did protest.
Oh,
many
boomers. Yeah. Many boomers. I would say probably most boomers were opposed to the Iraq War. I was not one who was opposed, and so you know I addressed that. But I would bet if you polled baby boomers that a majority or very close to a majority. We're opposed to the Iraq War. Yeah, there's no getting away from history, is there? You know, I mean, we keep paying the price of not only of our own errors, you know, and we got that coming, but we keep paying the price of other people's errors. The way that the European powers cut up the Middle East into sort of irrational slices, and of course Africa too, all the people in those places are paying the price right down to this day, and we end up paying the price too. And the attempt of the European powers after World War II to keep a hold of their colonies in an era when people like knew about the American Revolution and thought like maybe they, you know, could kind of go in the same direction. That's what led, you know, our supporting France trying to hold on to Vietnam. That's, you know, how we wound up. We got into Vietnam before most of the baby boom had been born.
Hey, I wondered in the time we have remaining, what you think about the good parts of the baby boom. In terms of legacy, you mentioned the kids that through generational changes, it is a kinder, gentler society certainly than the one that our parents handed us. You've noticed this with your own children or child?
I have, yeah, totally. I mean, it's a much more easygoing, accepting world. I can't imagine. One of my children, we do go to church. I mean, we're not like vividly religious, but we do go to Mass. And I can't imagine any of our children making a religiously charged remark about somebody who was Muslim, somebody who was Jewish, not even about somebody who was Protestant. Mm-hmm. Catholics tend to be pretty prejudiced against Protestants. It's like, the way my children talk about race, which is they don't really. I mean, or sexual orientation. I mean, they use if they talk about somebody being gay, they're using that word the way we would use tall. You know, it's an absolute neutral term of description. Their acceptance of others and their their sort of goodwill to others. I can't resist telling you, I know everybody hates cute things kids say, stories, but I still can't resist this one. When my 13-year-old daughter, about 4 or 5 years ago, came home from school.
We just have to keep it short, PJ.
She was asking about adoption, and we explained to her about, you know, they come up at school. We explained to her, and she said, well, you have a friend. You have friends that are adopted. And she said, I do. And we have these, like, Irish-German freckled short people who adopted a girl from Ethiopia. Beautiful, beautiful girl, sort of sable complexion, taller, you know, at 12 than both her parents combined. And we said, yeah, your friend Bette, she's adopted. And my daughter, she goes, yeah, I thought Bette looked a little different from her parents.
Good
that's
story.
That's their attitude toward race.
Right.
And that's a pretty
right.
beautiful thing.
It is.
It,
yeah? Good story to end our hour on, PJ. Nice to get to talk with you.
Thank you. It was really fun.
Yeah,
really
I enjoyed this conversation. P.J. O'Rourke, his latest book, The Baby Boom, How It Got That Way, and It Wasn't My Fault, and I'll Never Do It Again, published by, I can't remember the publisher of this book.
Grove
Atlantic. Way to go. Thank you, P.J.
You're welcome.
And thank you, everyone, for tuning in to our midday for today. We'll see you again soon. Have a great afternoon.